threatens.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapults to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
As we see the headlines every day, it's easy to come to the conclusion that the United States, in particular, is turning its back on God, and that we Christians are living in the midst of enemy territory. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest has written a book that touches on this subject. We've discussed it with him previously, but it's been a couple of years. We talked with him and his co-authors of the book, Final Babylon. His co-authors, Doug Woodward and Dean McGriff. He's also the author of Signs in the Heaven and on the Earth. His website, www.tribnet.org. It's our honor to welcome Doug Krieger to the program. Doug, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Derek, for having me on, and let's hope that this will be a very eventful exchange this morning.
Well, I believe it will. There's certainly enough going on to keep us going for, far more than just the one program here. Just to timestamp this for people listening in the archives at a future date, are recording this on Wednesday, July 8th of 2015. Mm-hmm. And it was just 10 days ago that the Supreme Court of the United States legalized homosexual marriage, gay marriage, in all 50 United States. Activists would like to point out that it was legal in 36 states prior to the Supreme Court ruling, but they neglect to point out that in 25 of those 36, it was legal only because a court had overruled the will of the people. We're already seeing calls for the legalization of polygamy, plural marriage. We're also seeing some real vitriol, some real anger that's been pent up in the hearts of activists, supporters of gay marriage, same-sex marriage, almost as though they're looking for some payback now against their perceived enemies, which would be conservative Bible-believing Christians. And based on the survey results I've seen, that means predominantly white conservative evangelical Christians. Now, the ironic thing is that African-American Christians are almost as opposed to same-sex marriage as white evangelicals, but that doesn't fit the narrative, so we'll just set that aside. Anyway, Doug, when you and your co-authors, Dean McGriff and Doug Woodward, wrote Final Babylon, did you see American society changing so rapidly in just a couple of years?
Well, like I wrote in my article, Derek, for your Skywatch magazine, we knew there were going to be twists and turns in the socioeconomic, the religious, the moral fabric of this country that would be happening in fairly rapid succession. However, when it does happen, we're out here on the left coast, and so we get all of these things ahead of time. When we and the governor signed into law that we could no longer call one another husband and wife, the bride and the groom, but that we had to use spouse and spouse in all of our legal documentation.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. This happened about maybe 2 months ago.
I somehow missed that.
Oh, yeah, you did. You missed a big one there. So we are inhibited from using the bride and the groom. We now must use terms such as, I now pronounce you a spouse and spouse. You may now kiss your spouse. And also pastors who are registered by the state of California, who file with the county clerk to be in a position and authorized by the state to marry people, you get a card that certifies you as a licensed person who can do this. And on that card, there's a big rainbow. In other words, your name is there under the rainbow. A very subtle, yet very straightforward notification that this state honors gay marriage, so-called. And I think that what we have to understand about this rage that you're alluding to here, Derek, you see, what the LGBTQ community so-called again, is after, is not that we respond to them. And I've heard well-meaning brethren talk about, you know, Doug, we just need to understand that Jesus loves everyone, regardless of their orientation. They could be in prison. They could have committed a heinous crime. They could be involved in heterosexual sin. They could be involved in homosexual sin. They could even be a reprobate mind. There's 3 degrees of sexual sin that are clearly defined in Romans chapter 1 by the Apostle Paul. And it's very clear where that eventually goes to is a reprobate mind. And yet, it's not an issue of love with the LGBT community. Justice Kennedy kept talking about dignity. What the LGBT community wants is they want us to sanctify their so-called unions. They want us to respect and dignify their practice. And as a born-again Christian, and as an evangelical Christian, and as a Christian who believes the scriptures, that's an impossibility. Otherwise, I would deny my faith. And here's one more thing that we have to be very clear about. This, if you would, continuous attack on traditional marriage in this nation, now codified by the Supreme Court of the land, is a direct assault against the archetype of the plan and purpose of God Almighty. When he created man, both male and female, he created them for a purpose to procreate, yes, but also he uses that man and woman imagery all the way to the conclusion of the scriptures in the Revelation, when the bride has made herself ready, and she is always referred to in the she as a pronoun, and as the woman of Revelation 12, and as the woman throughout, you know, basically 6,000 years of human history. And so the defamation and the now overt, the desecration of that imagery is at stake in this relationship, so that the LGBT community may not understand how, at the very core of true Christianity, if you destroy that archetype the way this is happening, you wind up with what Isaiah calls in Isaiah chapter 24, the city of confusion is broken down, which ultimately leads to the city of destruction. And there's a verse in scripture here, Derek, that in Isaiah chapter 23, it says, and it's been very difficult for commentators, expositors to determine if this ever happened historically. But in verse 17 of chapter 23, it says, "And it shall be at the end of 70 years that the Lord will deal with Tyre. She will return to her hire," now listen to this, "and commit fornication with all the kingdoms of the world on the face of the earth." Now that historically has never happened. And what the allusion is here, speaking of the Chaldeans in chapter 23, speaking of the ships of Tarshish, "Wail, you ships of Tarshish, for your strength is laid waste. Now it shall come to pass in that day that Tyre will be forgotten 70 years according to the days of one king. And at the end of 70 years, it will happen to Tyre as in the song of the harlot. Take a harp, go about the city, you forgotten harlot. Make sweet melody, sing many songs, that you may be remembered." Now, what's significant, if you would, eschatologically, prophetically, about this text in Isaiah 23 is that it leads right into Isaiah 24 on the impending judgment on the earth that has never happened before in the description given in Isaiah chapter 24. It is very clearly the judgment day upon the earth and its ruination and its ultimate destruction, as it was called, the city of confusion, of Babel, of Babylon, and then eventually it is the city of destruction. But prior thereto, you have these very incredible verses which clearly depict that at the end of 70 years, now God works in 70s. Of course, I'm a, you know, kind of a numbers guy here.
Mm-hmm.
And when I originally brought this up to Doug Woodward, he had not seen that connection in the scriptures before. Again, historically, at the end of 70 years, a lot of people think, well, that was after 70 years of the siege of the city of Tyre by Alexander the Great and the Greeks, and it was after this, and it was after that. It has never happened wherein all the kingdoms of the world on the face of the earth are going to commit fornication with the daughter of Tyre. And we have to understand that this understanding by Isaiah with regards to Tyre has everything to do with Jezebel's intrusion via Ahab and that whole sequence of events and stories that we find in at the end of 1 Kings and the beginning of 2 Kings in the Bible. How Israel was apostate and how that the worship of Baal and Ashtaroth was so pervasive. But what we don't understand is that it was pervasive with the 450 prostitutes that were female and the 400 that were male. They were both male and female prostitutes. And it was all connected to commerce, where traders of the earth would come to the temple and communicate with the gods on their own commercial deals. And this was big business. You would, at the time, go into the Temple of Baal, into these rooms, and basically, you know, fornicate in there, either with a male or a female. And then you would communicate with the gods during this whole thing. And these false prophets, these priests, would tell you whether your deal was going to go sour, whether you should get into it. Whatever question you had, it was almost like, you know, you're looking at 850 oracles of Delphi in there, communicating with the gods during these sexual exploits. And this was going on. So committing fornication with all the kingdoms of the earth, this was the highlight of what was happening with Israel's apostasy in the day of Elijah. And I would bring this up because it was the spirit of Elijah that confronted this very pervasive practice. And it was the spirit of Elijah which is prevalent in the book of Revelation, quite frankly, in Revelation 11, which confronts what's happening at the end of the age. And it shall come about at the end of these 70 years. 70 being an expression of a generation or a terminus at the end of 70 years. Now, remember, Isaiah is written prior to the captivity,
mm-hmm.
prior to Israel going into captivity into Babylon, and prior to the 10 tribes going into captivity with the Assyrians. This was happening. And so the historicity behind the context of these expressions that are happening here are very salient insofar as today's situation. And it's obvious, it's very obvious to anybody in the know here that if you permit and legalize so-called by the state these same-sex so-called marriages, the next step is pretty obvious. You're going to be getting what's, you know, good for two, could be good for three, four, five. You're going to get a polygamous situation. You're going to have all forms of degradation that will be coming in. And seriously, that's not far off. I mean, it can be argued very sternly right now that if a couple, two people of the same sex are legally married in the eyes of the state, now why not three? Why not four, five?
Yeah, there's no legal justification to restrict it to just two. And in fact, polygamists have more of a biblical case than homosexual activists do.
Well, yeah, and you know, quite interestingly enough, in some of the folks that I know that are into this, insofar as research goes, top Mormon authorities are currently right now talking with leading lights, if you would, in the LGBT community, questioning and saying, how did you do it? That you got same-sex marriage legalized and somehow we failed in polygamy. Maybe you can show us the ropes. How this came down.
That would be an interesting, that strange bedfellows for sure, because the Mormons were very, very active in helping to get Proposition 8 passed in California, which defined...
Yes, that would be very peculiar.
Yeah, defined marriage as one man and one woman, which of course then was overturned by Judge Vaughn Walker in the Ninth Circuit. Yep. Clearly the use of pop culture has helped a lot, because we look back over the last 10 years... saw some numbers that John Haller showed on his prophecy update this past weekend, that the attitudes of Americans of all ages have profoundly shifted over the last 10 years. And I think that our entertainment, pop culture, has had a lot to do with that. And because we've abandoned the Bible as a standard of right and wrong, and now we are using our heart as a guide. We judge whether something is right or wrong based on how it makes us feel, which was pretty clear in the opinions written by the majority in the Supreme Court. It was all based on feeling, was not based on law, was not based on any objective standard of morality, simply on the basis of, you know, they really want to get married, and it would be mean not to let them do so, and so we should go ahead and let them get married.
Yeah, and the thing of it is that the entire, again, I bring it back to the issue of dignity and respect. We have a very good friend of ours who is engaged in this lifestyle, if you would, and we very clearly told him, we said, you know, brother, when the woman at the well met Jesus, she was engaged, obviously, in heterosexual sin, very empty person. Jesus presented himself as the water of life. And he forgave her, and he told her, go and sin no more.
Right.
Now, why didn't he say, you know, I really understand that you're a very empty person. Now, you can have me in your life, and just continue as is. But just remember, you're forgiven. We understand that you have this proclivity. We understand. And Jesus didn't say that at all. He said, go and sin no more. And we told this brother, you know, Jesus forgives you. We forgive you. And if you repent of your sin, and now go and sin no more. This is true Christianity. And so we've gotten so far away from this. Again, in the book, The Final Babylon, you know, the moral decline of the nation is one thing, but this is you know, turning and it turns on commercialism. If you'll notice, you're getting the big corporations, many of whom or certainly a good portion of whom make good money off of this stuff, and as soon as you ban the practice, quote, we're cutting you off commercially. The big issue in the LGBTQ community and concern is what will other nations do with this if you travel to Kenya? They're coming out with new laws banning this practice. Uganda, places all over traditional Africa are outraged over this decision. And so how's that going to affect? Well, if that nation is going to put into effect these kinds of laws, then maybe we should have some sanctions against that nation to punish them for these prosecutorial laws against our people. Doesn't that make sense? So this isn't over by a long shot as far as the LGBT community is concerned. And, you know, I have said the imagery that you see in Revelation 17 and throughout the these accounts that you see in the book of Kings in particular, the Kings, is that there is a woman riding a beast. The imagery there is that the beast is the state, and that the woman is an apostate, Jezebelian, if you would, expression. Now, you haven't heard that word from anybody. I just made that one up. But she is an expression of a church who was a golden cup in the hand of the Lord at one time, and has now become her cup full of putridities and abominations. And that she has sought the support of the state, and the state has sought her moral covering to do what it wants to do. And eventually what happens is the beast turns on the woman. And that's what we are seeing today, Derek, is that beast is turning on the woman. And so we have a situation here. And I told this one pastor here locally, I said, well, aren't you an agent of the state, technically speaking? He very clearly said, well, actually, I've used that expression on a number of occasions.
Sure. When they sign a marriage license, they are.
They are, absolutely. And number two is that, you know, if there's, of course, any child abuse or there's a problem in his congregation, same thing with the Catholic Church. I mean, you have got to go to the state authorities. Child Protective Services needs to know this. This agency needs to know this. You are, in essence, an agent of the state. My encouragement to these dear brethren is, isn't it about time to get off the beast? Now, what does that look like? Well, one thing is that as long as you're running around with this 501c3, you may have some issues. You may lose that ability of receiving monies because you, as a authorized by LG, Lyndon Baines Johnson, got all these churches to agree with this 501c3 business. LBJ was the one who did it.
Right.
And eventually now we have a situation where the government can control the situation, strictly speaking, against the Constitution of the United States, to make no law inhibiting the practice of religion in the state. And so it is just the exact opposite. So now we have a situation that is rapidly unraveling. And the interesting thing about all of this, Derek, is I do believe for the first time that Christians who take their Bible seriously are beginning to realize deep down inside there has been a sea change that has been going on here. And grief, you know, this house of cards could very well be coming down. Now, we can get into several mindsets here. Let me be very clear. You can circle the wagons and go Amish. You can.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about.
Uh-huh.
You can circle the wagons, go Amish, and look for Zion. You can, at the same time, you can take a stand with the two witnesses in the street of the great city and confront this monster along a variety of lines. And, of course, that may ultimately cost us. It will, in fact, if we follow the accounting here, although Elijah does get raptured at the end of 7 years, I hasten to add.
Yes, yes.
But here's the thing. The cost is out there. Jesus knew. And that's my other book that I have, is The Testimony of Jesus, I just wrote. He knew that if he went to Jerusalem, and he had purposed this, and it was in the plan and purpose of the Almighty, that he would go and be crucified and be cut off, but not for himself, but for us and our salvation. But he knew that going into Jerusalem, given the environment, that especially if he confronted the authorities, by, number one, throwing out the money changers from the temple, number two, taking on the high priest, the chief priest, the scribes, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Herodians, the Romans, even an attorney. John, I always bring that up for John Haller's sake. I said, look, he won, and then he, you know, he talked to the multitudes. He got Peter, Andrew, James, and John off to the side and shared with them how this was all going to come down. He knew eventually it was the cross. And that is, in the book of Revelation, the faithful and true witness, which is his description. The word witness there means martyr. Antipas, my faithful martyr. The two witnesses of Revelation 11 are literally, the word there is martyria. They are my two martyrs. From the very get-go, their faith was a faith worth dying for. In other words, what I'm saying here is that we, like Elijah, who turned the water, Moses turned the water into blood, and Elijah shut up the heavens that it rained not for 3 years and 6 months. Well, by the way, that 3 years and 6 months, Derek?
Yes.
That's, you don't see that in the Old Testament. You see 3 years. But Jesus and James both mentioned that Elijah shut up the heavens that it rained not for 3 years and 6 months.
That's interesting. 42 months, that's half the period of the tribulation.
Very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Two sets, I hasten to add.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So what we have here is a clear picture. Elijah said this to the people of Israel that were at the altar when this was all coming down. Why do you waver between two opinions? Either serve Yahweh or Baal. But you can't have both. And see, this is the judgment that begins at the house of God first. There is a winnowing that is going on, Derek. And it's becoming very, very clear. Now, I've been very impressed with Franklin Graham's position and his outspokenness on this whole matter. We are not here to win a popularity contest. This is not a quote, and I worked with Joel Aldridge, so I'm very clear about friendship evangelism, which has unfortunately been distorted as to its real meaning. My sister has a new book coming out that we're going to be publishing entitled Gone Fishing. It's a 30 stories of people who have found Jesus in the most unbelievable situations, and it shows how every one of us can share the gospel and the good news.
Yeah, and need to. Yeah.
So we're going to stand in the street of that great city. The great city is Babylon the Great. Now, I'm clear that it's a great commercial empire, it is a great political empire, and it is as well an apostate religious system that becomes very obvious and prevailing, especially at the end of days.
Well,
it is a mixture, and that is what happens here in Isaiah 23 and ultimately then 24 in the judgment.
Well, let me ask you about that again, because you related the situation in America today and the relationship of churches through the 501c3 tax exemption to the government. And the status of pastors and priests as government agents, especially as regards child relations and marriage licenses and so forth, to the woman on the beast. And I think most people, self included, would interpret the woman in scarlet of Revelation as a global religious system. How does your interpretation fit our situation in America today, religious political system, into the prophecy of Revelation 17.
Yeah, I know exactly where you're going with this. And here's the thing. If you'll notice, the Irish vote to sanction same-sex marriage in Ireland, notwithstanding, you know, the Archbishop and the Cardinals and everything in Ireland who opposed it, the vote was overwhelming, you know, 60-some-odd percent plus, and they voted to do this. What we have to understand is, Little Ireland doesn't affect and impact the world. If you look at this verse in Isaiah 23, she returns to her hire and commits fornication with, you know, with all the kingdoms of the world on the face of the earth. There is no other nation on the planet that can effectively impact the entire earth through her communication system, her technologies, her cultural impact. I mean, you can't go anywhere on the globe without being impacted by American culture.
That's
true. You simply cannot do so. And it's impossible. So, you know, for good or for evil, this is the case. And so whatever happens here is, you know, we catch a cold here, they all get pneumonia. We have a situation here developing. And remember, Babylon is mystery. It is mystery Babylon the Great. And so we've, you know, for a couple of hundred years, and a lot of the reformers, even to this day, you know, well, Babylon is a mystery. Babylon is Mother Rome. It is the Roman Catholic Church, and that settles that. Quite frankly, the Vatican, much vaunted in her financial extremes from time to time, and her difficulties that she's had with regards to... hang on for a second here. That was the Vatican call.
Yes, the Chinese stock market alert.
Yeah, it just collapsed. Okay. But the thing of it is this. When you have a picture of commercial Babylon, given in Revelation, in particular 18, that all the shipmasters, all the sailors of the world trade with her, I get a big kick out of people who say, well, you know, obviously, this has to be, since she slayed the prophets, this has to be Jerusalem. Now, the Jews are behind all of this. They control all the finances of the world. Therefore, the end of days picture that we see here is Jerusalem is Mystery Babylon. Now, go figure. How does Jerusalem surround Jerusalem in the prophetical scenario? You know, the Antichrist comes up against Jerusalem, you know, at the very climax of all of this from the book of Zechariah. We can see that very clearly. And so that is so off the map. What our book did, and what Doug Woodward did such a good job at, a paradigm shift is needed geopolitically in our thinking from a European model. Obviously, after two world wars and, you know, the transplanting of most of our culture from Europe to North America, we have to understand this mystery has been moving westward from the very beginning. If you look at what happened in ancient Babylon, and then it moves, Medo-Persia moves further west into Turkey and Asia Minor, then the Greeks, and then the Romans. This thing keeps going westward. And that's why you see this ram coming out of the west in the book of Daniel. And so, you know, again, you've got this mixture that it can be traced right straight through from the very birth of the church, all the way to where we are now. So with regards to the settling of North America, it was, if you would, it was done by the crown. That's political. It was done by the commerce, which is commercial. That was the main reason. And it was done by the cross. Those are the three C's. Hmm. And we're doing this to evangelize the world. So you've got commerce. You've got, you know, the cross. you've got the crown. And this is the tripartite nature of Babylon. And that's why when you get to the book of Revelation in chapter 16, that when Babylon is destroyed, she is broken up into three parts. Those three parts are clearly delineated in Revelation 17 of religious Babylon is mentioned first, the woman who rides the beast, who turns on her in Revelation 17. In Revelation 18, it is a very clear picture of commercial Babylon that goes up in smoke, and all the shipmasters who traded with her by sea weep their hearts out. I mean, if you're going to weep, weep when you're, you know, you've lost your big trading partner, right? And number three, then, eventually, in Revelation 19, you see the judgment of the beast and the false prophet, the second beast. That is the judgment of political Babylon. Meaning what? Meaning it would appear that Babylon the Great shall persist until the very coming of the Lord himself. Now, I'm talking to Christians here. Now, you may believe you're involved in getting out of here sooner than later, but most people who are even pre-tribulational in their eschatology are beginning to realize, say, wait a minute, this may get really heavy before we get out of here.
Well, Jesus promised we would, that his followers would suffer tribulation.
Absolutely.
It does not necessarily mean great tribulation. As,
that's right.
Yeah. In the day
and
of
so,
the Lord.
And not only that, you know, I always get a, I don't want to get too much into this because I know it can be a very prickly subject. However, we have looked at Revelation 3:10 for many years that we are going to be kept from the hour of trial, which is to try all them that dwell on the earth. Understand, Ray Steadman was really good at this. He was the pastor out here at Peninsula Bible for years, very much involved in the Jesus movement as we were. But Ray brought out that, and it does appear 11 separate times, 11 being the number of the Antichrist, the 11th horn, in the book of Revelation, the phrase, dwell on the earth. And it's always mentioned in a very negative connotation, meaning the ones who have their fingers in the material. These are the ones who eventually make it very clear that the two witnesses who tormented them, you know, are gone. So, you know, who have you tormented lately, Derek? Now, in other words, I get a kick out of the
depends on who you ask.
I said, well, you know, are you sharing the Lord with anybody? You know, the Bible presents itself. No, are you tormenting anybody? You know, I talk about, you know, these reunions that I have from time to time, and I go to these reunions, and anybody that I see out there, I get a chance to share the Lord with them, right? And then, oh, here he comes. He's back again. You know, they're relatives, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, he's doing his thing again, that little tormentor. And so, you know, we're supposed to be the light of the world, sit on a hill, right? And when the light goes on, the cockroaches flee.
Yes, yes.
So the thing of it is that it's the picture of Babylon the Great will persist to the very end of the age. There will be a confrontation. As far as that goes, the testimony of Jesus will be given. It is a testimony to die for. It is a testimony that has to be given under the spirit of prophecy, which is the testimony of Jesus. You know, Francis of Assisi said, well, you know, you want to share your faith, you may have to use words from time to time. Well, no joke. How shall they hear without a preacher? Now, Elijah, you get yourself back there. So he goes back and tells King Ahab, you're going down. You killed Naboth and all his sons, by the way, I hasten to add. And they are buried in the field that we took by eminent domain, Ahab and Jezebel. And they threw a banquet for Naboth, and the two sons of Belial were sitting in the front row, and they got up and said, he's against the king, and he's against Yahweh. How about that? He's against God and country. Let's get rid of Elijah. Hmm. No, let's get rid of Naboth. Here comes Elijah. And all the while, there's this guy, Obadiah, who's a spiritual counselor believe it or not, of the 70, there's that 70 again, sons of Ahab, and Obadiah hides the prophets of the Lord in two caves, two being the number of witness. You know, 50 in this cave and 50 in this cave, and I'm feeding them bread and water. And by the way, Elijah, I have feared the Lord from my youth. You know, you go tell Ahab, Elijah's back, and the 3.5 years of drought are going to end, and I'm going to face off with King Ahab. He tells King Ahab, you're exposed, buddy. Okay, you have killed Naboth. This is after his return. And you're going down. And then Ahab says, don't get rid of me. You know, I got to live a little bit longer. And so he repents. No kidding, right? He knows that his time is short. So he lasts for another 3.5 years. At which point we have the rapture of Elijah. And we have Elisha coming on. And then we have two peculiar stories, Derek, of, you know, 42 lads who mock Elisha on his way up to Bethel after Elijah.
Yeah, that's a really curious account. They're mocking his bald head.
Not only that, you got the 42 sons of King Abijah who come up and say, we want to talk to Jezebel, talk with their kids and all this other stuff. Actually, they had something else in mind, but there were 42 of them. And they're all slain by who? King Jehu, who was anointed by Elijah to get rid of all of these Baalites. Here's the thing, two sets of 42. Have you ever seen in the Revelation that there are 42 months in which the court of the Gentiles treads asunder the holy city, and there are 42 months given to the beast? There are only two sets of 42 in the Old Testament and two sets of 42 in the New. And when you add them together, they come up to, guess what, 84 is 42 and 42, and 42 and 42 on the other side turn out to be 84, and two sets of 84 come to 168. How many hours are there in a week? 168. Now, is that wink-a-ding? I find these numbers and these number sets so incredible, and I just, you know, and what I did, Derek, I just throw this in a little bit, is that Matthew's gospel introduces Jesus and his generations as 14 generations, 14 generations, and 14 generations, right? And when you look at it all up, you add 14, 14, 14, what does that equal? 42.
42, yeah.
Add 42 to 168, and you know what you get? You get 210. You know what 210 is? 21, which is the fractal or resemblance of the Hebrew sacred cubit of 2.1 feet, meaning that Jesus is the center, the nexus, the halfway point between, you know, Abraham and himself and his second coming. This is what is presented by Matthew. Those verses have been always mystifying to me. I believe that they are clearly demonstrating that Jesus Christ is the meaning of history, and that these two sets of 42 on the one side and the two sets of 42 on the other are there to show us that at the climax of the age, there is a confrontation between the holy city and the great city. And the holy city is clearly, at the end of the Bible, presented as a new Jerusalem descending out of heaven as a bride prepared for the groom. I hasten to add again. And so that this confrontation that is going on with the definition of marriage, in one sense, we can't look at it in a superficial way. This has a profoundly significant meaning in the spiritual world. This is what we have to come to terms with.
On a couple of levels, because not only does it contradict God's original design for humanity, you know, in the beginning created he them male and female, there are long-standing traditions in the occult realm, and I'm just now reading Mark Flynn's remarkable book, Hidden Secrets of the Labyrinth.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Yeah, which details some of the deeper meaning behind the gods' and how mystical and occult traditions have picked up on these, and the importance of androgyny mm-hmm. and removal of gender definitions in these occult practices, and ultimately
just to insert real quickly.
Yeah.
Have you heard of the new phenomenon where people want to marry themselves?
Well, it doesn't surprise me.
There's a big thing going out here in California. I want to marry myself. And you think to yourself, where did that come from?
Well, you know, gender fluidity. Today I'm male, tomorrow I'll be female, and I'll just marry the male and female halves of myself into one. Well, that's what the whole occult drive is. I mean, this belief that mankind, or this lie that mankind was created androgynous in the beginning, and we need to return to that androgynous state. That's what gender fluidity and this drive to erase God's gender division, gender definitions, is all about.
Well, and also, wouldn't we say that if Adam's in the garden hiding himself, and God is walking in the cool of the day and says, Adam, where are you? I'm figuring, hey, if God doesn't know where Adam is, we're all in trouble. Right?
Exactly, right.
Well, but here's the thing. God wants a relationship with another part of his creation. He wants that relationship. He wants to sit down with Abraham. He wants to be the friend of God in Abraham. He wants Abraham to be his friend. He said to his disciples, you are my friends, okay? This is something much more intimate. God is not, Jesus is knocking on the door. He wants to come in. Mm-hmm. He what does he want to do? He wants to sup with you. He wants to eat with you. When he resurrected, what did he do? He didn't get up in front of a million people gathered for the Passover and say, hey, I'm resurrected. Look at over here. He saw two guys on the road to Emmaus all bummed out. And he, you know, basically broke bread with them. And in the breaking of the bread, they saw who he was. He wants fellowship, intimate fellowship with us. You cannot have fellowship unless there's another, if you would, fellow.
Right.
And so this is the entire picture. God made man his own image that he might, express himself through that man and have that person, that male and female, to love him and for him to have that unmitigated love toward them. And you have to have that in a relational fashion. That's true Christianity. True Christianity is absolutely relational. And when that relationship is broken, then it is because of sin. And that's the challenge that we face today. So when we wrote The Final Babylon, we made it very clear that who we think this identity is. It's very tangible. The Bible deals in tangibility. The ships of Tarshish are clearly mentioned here, the great trading empire of the Mediterranean, the first truly commercial empire, clearly illustrated in the text, and its relationship with apostate Israel, and the ultimate confrontation primarily with Elijah and Elisha. What we have here are clearly defined confrontational points that ultimately cannot be avoided. We have to go back. We may look into her cup of putridities. We may run to Mount Horeb after 40 days in the wilderness. We may flee into the wilderness. But eventually, we have to come back, and we have to be able to face off with King Ahab and expose the compromisers, Obadiah, who allegedly fears the Lord from his youth, but he's scared to death. He's going to be killed by King Ahab. Everybody's looking for you, Elijah, and now you're telling me to go tell King Ahab you're here? He's going to think I've been hiding you in one of these caves. And so he doesn't want to be exposed. He doesn't want to be exposed. And yet he's the spiritual counselor of Yahweh to the king.
Mm-hmm.
What a mixed bag do we have here? And so, when she is eventually judged, tossed out of the window, the dogs, lick up her blood and eat everything but her extremities because they're so perfumed with poison, her hands, her feet, her head. And guess where she's ultimately buried and used as fertilizer? in the plot of Naboth. Vengeance is mine. I will repay,
saith the Lord. Amen.
How about that?
Well, it is a challenge, and I know this is a conversation that could continue on for quite a while, and we will continue it on this program in the weeks and months ahead. Again, the profound change in the 10 years that Sharon and I have been doing PID Radio in the attitudes of Americans, of American Christians even, even among American evangelicals, a majority of whom still hold to the biblical definition of marriage. The number of those who are willing to accept same-sex marriage has doubled in the last 10 years. So we are losing the battle for our pews. It's no wonder that we've lost the battle, or apparently lost the battle for our culture. But there is coming a day when that will be made right. And Doug said, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, I will repay. Doug Krieger is the author, co-author of the book The Final Babylon, along with Doug Woodward and Dean McGriff, author of Signs in the Heaven and on the Earth. And we'll have to get into that at some point in the near future and talk about the numerological significance of the various numbers that we find in the Bible. I listened to your interview with the fellows at Canary Cry Radio last year as I was staining a deck. And it was one of those things where I was missing spots in the deck because I had to keep stopping and backing up my iPod to hear it, you know, the same spot again and again to try to absorb what y'all were talking about. So we'll have to get into that at some point in the future. Doug's website is tribnet.com.
.org.
.com is a news organization website.
Yeah,
a newspaper.
Tacoma Tribune.
Yeah, there. Yeah. So tribnet.org, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes to make sure I get it right. Doug, thanks for your time today. We'll talk again soon.
You bet. God bless, Derek. Really appreciate it.
As always, the show notes at vftb.net are where you find a link to our guest's website. That's tribnet.org, not .com. I'll make sure I get it right so we send you to the right place. And keep an eye on the forthcoming edition of Skywatch Magazine, because Doug Krieger will have an article in the magazine, along with Doug Woodward, Josh Peck, and if I can get off the schneid and start writing, hopefully have another one as well. Saw something really interesting in Transcendence, the Johnny Depp movie about artificial intelligence, that tracked with some things that I've been reading from Mark Flynn in his excellent book, Hidden Secrets of the Labyrinth. So hopefully we'll be able to condense that into a couple thousand words, and we'll get that as, in the Skywatch magazine as well. As I'm recording this on Wednesday, July 8th of 2015, it's been a really interesting day. It was up a little too late last night because the Chinese stock market began really melting down after hours, or after hours for us in the U.S. anyway. This is something that's been going on for a while, and I'm remiss in not having paid attention to this because the Chinese population is the largest in the world, so what affects them is going to affect the rest of us, especially since China holds so much United States debt. Their stock market, the exchanges in Shanghai and Shenzhen, have lost between 30 and 40% of their value in the last 3 weeks. That's a lot. In fact, that's about $3 trillion in value that has just evaporated, gone up into smoke, thin air. It wasn't real value because it was backed by paper. And as we discovered in 2007, 2008, that can disappear in a hurry when our real estate bubble collapsed. The Chinese government is frantically trying to keep this bubble inflated for a number of reasons. Pride is one. Another being that, unlike the United States and other Western countries where most of the investors in the stock market are institutional investors, banks, hedge funds, retirement funds, and so forth, money market accounts, whatever, money market managers, rather. Most of the investors, 80% in China, are individuals, people like you and me that just go to the bank, withdraw their savings, and put it into the stock market because the market had really been overheated in China for quite some time. It was among the world's best performing stock exchange so far this year, and it hit a 7-year high in June. So it was really tempting for people to put their money into the market. In fact, we remember this in the United States back about 10 years ago, where we were seeing ads all the time for software that would allow us to become day traders in our spare time at home and make big money playing the stock market. And a lot of people were lured into that and lost a lot of money when things hit the skids. Now, the Dow Jones has inflated again because the Federal Reserve has been printing money left and right. The Chinese government apparently trying to do something similar, but it doesn't seem to be working this time. And that's why I have to put on my conspiratorial hat, because I'm not much of a coincidence theorist. And I have to wonder if what's going on in China over the last month or so is just an accident. Yes, their market's been overheated. Yes, it's been inflated by perhaps rules that have been a little looser than they should have been, allowing people to get into the market. But at the same time this has been going on, there have been some other things happening on the world financial markets, world financial stage anyway. The Chinese government has been, they just hosted a signing ceremony for the charter of the new Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the AIIB. Over 50 nations are a part of this bank, which is a competitor of the World Bank, which is based here in the United States. The U.S. and Japan oppose this bank. They're not happy about it, but American allies, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, Germany, and others, South Korea, are charter members of this new bank, which is a big jewel in the crown of China. It's a really enhances their image on the world stage. Also, the International Monetary Fund every 5 years will get together and meet and decide how to allocate currencies in the basket of currencies that backs up the International Monetary Fund's so-called special drawing rights. Okay, and there's talk that the IMF was planning on including the Chinese currency, the yuan, or officially called the renminbi, in the basket of currencies. China would love for the renminbi to become a reserve currency, one of those currencies that you have to keep in the bank in order to do business internationally. Right now, the dollar, U.S. dollar, is the de facto reserve currency of the world. Even though there are other currencies that nations will hold. But the United States is really the one you've got to hold in reserve in your bank vaults if you want to do business internationally. China would love to get a piece of the action. And analysts have said that if the IMF were to include the renminbi as part of its basket of currencies, it could move as much as $1 trillion out of U.S. dollars and into the renminbi as reserve currency. So I just wonder, and I have no evidence to support this whatsoever. I'm just speculating here because I don't believe in coincidences. Is there something going on behind the scenes to devalue the renminbi, to poke a hole in the Chinese economy, which has been growing, they say, at an average rate of 7 to 8% a year for years now, partly because they've been building cities in which no one lives, shopping malls in which there are no stores and so forth, because of this stupid formula that says any dollar, any money that a government spends counts towards its gross domestic product, which is insane. But be that as it may, that's how they were able to tell investors that their economy was continuing to grow, and regional officials, bureaucrats, were able to meet their targets by, you know, improvement projects that really didn't improve anything. So maybe it's just time for the house of cards to collapse. But maybe there are cyber warriors behind the scenes who are doing things to torpedo the Chinese economy so that the IMF is less likely to make the renminbi a reserve currency, perhaps. Or maybe make the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank look a little less secure when it comes to needing financing for that next international public works project or whatever. That just, again, theorizing. I took a look at a website that was linked from ZeroHedge.com today called Norse Corp, N-O-R-S-E, Norse Corp, which provides a real-time visual map of cyber attacks. And it looked like hackers in China were just hammering the United States today. And coincidentally, or maybe not, at 11:32 Eastern time this morning, the New York Stock Exchange suddenly halted trading. Unexpectedly, without warning, just all trades that are open now are officially not open, closed. and it was several hours before the stock exchange opened again. Officials at the New York Stock Exchange say that it was a technical issue. They've not told us what it is. United Airlines had a problem this morning. All of their planes were suddenly subject to a global, what they call a ground stop. All their planes were grounded for a couple of hours this morning. They also had a technical problem, a router that failed, computer router. The Wall Street Journal was knocked offline for a while. Coincidence? I don't know. Looking at that map from Norse Corp, it looked like whatever the Chinese hackers were after, it was located in St. Louis, Missouri, at least when I was looking late morning, early afternoon. What's there? I don't know. The government has some installations there. I did some research on that 10 years ago, actually, for my novel, The God Conspiracy. There's actually something there regarding mapping that was kind of important, but things may have changed in the last 10 years. I'm not sure. Was this all connected? I don't know. Just really odd that suddenly the Chinese stock market tanks and suddenly the New York Stock Exchange is knocked offline for several hours for an undisclosed technical problem. Hope to have a guest to talk about this later in this week. I've reached out to Dean McGriff, who is one of the co-authors of Final Babylon, along with Doug Krieger and Doug Woodward, and hopefully we'll be able to talk with him about it. Finance is his bailiwick, so we can hopefully get an opinion and some analysis from somebody who actually knows what he's talking about. But we'll let you know more about that. Just watch the website. Of course, the Twitter feed is always there, too. You can subscribe to the Twitter feed where we try to keep up with things that are going on around the world. It's at viewfrombunker, twitter.com. At viewfrombunker is the handle there. Skywatch Television, the Roku channel, is the place to watch the daily news updates that I post. Of course, the YouTube channel will have those as well. But if you've got a Roku account, log on and just do a search for Skywatch TV and add that channel to your account. It is updated on pretty much a daily basis, Monday through Friday. We've got the weekly programs up there, the daily shows up there. And if you just want to hear the audio so you don't have to look at me, you can do that as well. At Skywatch TV. We appreciate your reviews on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you find A View from the Bunker, which is a production of Gilbert House and released under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert. This is A View from the Bunker.